One of the most interesting aspects of the two Corinthian letters is that apparently in Corinth, Paul himself was under attack, and his apostolic authority was called into question, which allows Paul in both letters some occasion to say some things about his apostolate. There are a couple of poems in here that mention Paul, but I'm going to read one that has something to do with Peter from Carol's Elements of Hope this morning. Isn't that him walking on the water? Oh, Peter, please, no more of your foolishness. What we need in times like these, times of crisis, are restraint and common sense. No, no, just look there. Don't you see the figure where the waves crest? I'd swear it's him. Peter, stop and think. Water will support no one. Men sink. Besides, he is gone. We must live without visions, without him. But I tell you, it is him. He's beckoning. Peter, we worry about you. You are not yourself. You are a practical man. We hate to say it, but you may need professional help. Stand back. I'm going over the side. We can't permit it. You will drown. You are not responsible. Let go of me. It's him. He's calling me. Peter, we hate to use force. Quit struggling. The water will not hold you. It would not hold him, even if he were here. But he is gone. He would want you to be sensible. Think, Peter, think. Give me my cloak. Oh, that's more foolishness of yours. No one puts on a cloak before jumping into the water. Give it to me. He's waiting. Well, can you swim? Oh, dear, he's gone. Swim, Peter, swim. Do you see that? Good old Peter walking on the water. What do you think of that? I think Peter is magnificent in his backwardness. We might towel ourselves before bathing or say goodbye on meeting. But Peter, he wraps himself in death before leaping into life. I like these poems, I think. I've lumped together a couple of sections. We've really been marching rapidly, I think, through the letter, the First Corinthian letter. Today, I think we can take a little bit more, a little bit less chunk of text. Only the ninth chapter and a few verses from the 11th and a few verses from the 14th chapter. I've sort of put them together under clergy concerns, and one of the issues that we'll want to take up is Paul and women clergy, but with a kind of question mark, I'm not sure that clergy is what is being talked about, but it's been applied that way. The other section is 1 Corinthians 9, where Paul responds, in a sense, to an attack on his apostolate, and where he says, I think, some very, very interesting things about clergy compensation. And that, I hope, will lead us for a little while into some sort of conversation on the whole nature of clergy functioning in the church. Let's take 9 first. Paul begins, am I not free? Am I not an apostle? Have I not seen Jesus our Lord? Are you not my workmanship in the Lord? I guess a comment here, the point or Paul's questions arise again out of his discussion in chapter 8 on how to relate to people who in their weakness are not able to eat meat that has been offered at the temples without, in a sense, damaging their own conscience. So Paul's first question, am I not free, is really a way of saying, haven't I experienced the liberation that comes from the gospel? I could, if I wanted to, do whatever I want. But the point he's trying to make now is that he has not made use of the whole issue of rights and his freedom to do what he wants. He applies this now specifically to compensation. If to others I am not an apostle, at least I am to you, for you are the seal of my apostleship in the Lord. And this is my defense to those who would examine me. Do we not have the right to our food and drink? Do we not have the right to be accompanied by a wife, as the other apostles and the brothers of the Lord and Cephas or Peter? Or is it only Barnabas and I who have no right to refrain from working for a living? I'm reminded here that the beginning of the sort of modern critical era of biblical studies goes back to a man named Hermann Samuel Reimarus, who left behind him at his death in 1768 some fragments that were discovered and published later on by Gotthold Ephraim Lessing. And in these fragments, Reimarus mounted a kind of bitter attack on the whole of the New Testament. The whole thing was a fraud, he said. The apostles discovered how easy it was to go around preaching the kingdom and not having to work for a living. And so when Jesus died, they didn't want to give up a good thing, so they invented the notion of a first and second coming, and then went on preaching instead of working for a living. Well, Paul is almost reinforcing that, saying, don't I have a right like the other apostles not to work for a living? I had a professor in Germany who said, in one sense at least, clergy really aren't doing anything useful in the world. Maybe a lot of people have always thought that, but here it's just said flat out. His point, however, was that that itself can be a sign, in a sense, a sign really, that all of the activities and enterprises of this life and this world will really come to an end. That the clergy are a sign of the end of this world and the presence of something else. But at any rate, Paul's point is, I have a right, in a sense, to refrain from working for a living, but I didn't use that right. He goes on, who serves as a soldier at his own expense? Who plants a vineyard without eating any of its fruit? Who tends a flock without getting some of the milk? I worry about some of these analogies. I keep...
You're blushing.
Ah, well. Do I say this on human authority? Does not the law say the same? For it is written in the law of Moses, you shall not muzzle an ox when it is treading out the grain. Is it for oxen that God is concerned? Does he not speak entirely for our sake? It was written for our sake, because the plowman should plow in hope, and the thresher thresh in hope of a share in the crop. If we have sown spiritual good among you, is it too much if we reap your material benefits? If others share this rightful claim upon you, do we not still more? Nevertheless, he goes on, we have not made use of this right, but we endure anything rather than put an obstacle in the way of the gospel of Christ. When I came to my first parish, again, just a gloss, I came to my first parish and I had a delightful, very elderly German couple in the congregation. Both of them were housebound. They really weren't able to get out anymore. And so I began to call on them, as I did on all of the shut-in people in the parish, about once every 3 weeks or so. And I took my communion set along, but they always refused. And finally I asked them once what the problem was, and it turned out that they were always used to giving the pastor $5 every time he brought communion, and they couldn't afford it very often. And it was just an appalling discovery to make that had been their tradition. I don't know whether it was the pastor's tradition, but it had been their tradition. They were living on a very, very modest income and simply felt they couldn't afford to pay for the sharing in the Eucharist. It was a terrifying discovery. He says, we endure anything rather than put an obstacle in the way of the gospel of Christ. Do you not know that those who are employed in the temple service get their food from the temple? He's back to the same argument again. And those who serve at the altar share in the sacrificial offerings. In the same way, the Lord commanded that those who proclaim the gospel should get their living by the gospel. Now back to the main point. I have made no use of any of these rights, nor am I writing this to secure any such provision. I would rather die than have anyone deprive me of my ground for boasting. For if I preach the gospel, that gives me no ground for boasting. For necessity is laid upon me. Woe to me if I do not preach the gospel. For if I do this of my own will, I have a reward. But if not of my own will, I am entrusted with a commission. What then is my reward? Just this, that in my preaching I may make the gospel free of charge, not making full use of my rights in the gospel. For though I am free from all men, I have made myself slave to all, that I might win the more. To the Jews I became as a Jew in order to win Jews. To those under the law I became as one under the law, though not being myself under the law, that I might win those under the law. To those outside the law I became as one outside the law, not being without the law toward God, but under the law of Christ, that I might win those outside the law. To the weak I became weak, that I might win the weak. I have become all things to all men, that I might by all means save some. I do it for the sake of the gospel, that I may share in its blessings. And then a little commentary on that last sentence. Do you not know that in a race all the runners compete, but only one receives the prize? So run that you may obtain it. Every athlete exercises self-control in all things. They do it to receive a perishable wreath, but we an imperishable. I do not run aimlessly. I do not box as one beating the air, but I pummel my body and subdue it, lest after preaching to others, I myself should be disqualified. Now, to take up the issues involved here, Paul is saying in one sense that as an apostle, he has a right to be supported financially by the people to whom he preaches. But he has not exercised that right, and he gives as his reason for it that the gospel itself may be the focus, not the question, what is he doing this for, or what is he going to get out of it, but that the gospel itself might be the real focus as he encounters people. And I think that this chapter, at least, raises some very large questions for us today. We are very accustomed today, I think, to a salaried clergy. And we need to ask ourselves how, in fact, that affects the character of the ministry. This afternoon, Hans is going to lead a book discussion on a devastating book by Olaf Hartmann called Holy Masquerade, in which, in the context of the Church of Sweden, the pastor who is a civil servant, who is getting his salary paid through the civil service bureau of the Swedish state, functions not responsibly vis-a-vis his parishioners as a pastor to them, but functions with an eye towards his career, his promotion, his advancement, cultivating those people who can further his career, making very sure that he is satisfying the bureaucracy in Stockholm, and in effect then neglecting certain pastoral activities. We might say to ourselves, and I suppose Hartmann's book is in a sense so devastating, at least in European circumstances, because if you look at the European churches, in most instances, clergy are salaried employees, at least of a tax-supported bureaucracy. We might say to ourselves, but it's all different here in America. And in a sense, it is, and in a sense, it's very much the same, or it may even be more devastating here. Sidney Mead, in his book on the American denomination called The Lively Experiment, has pointed out that the American church is characterized above all by voluntary membership, which means that clergy, in a sense, have to acquire in some way their own clientele. And we look upon this as an occasion for great freedom. And it is indeed an occasion for great freedom. The state makes no provision for what gets preached in the churches. You can preach anything you want, provided that you have a clientele that will, in a sense, support that proclamation. But what this has done, in a sense, is to make the clergy, in a sense, client-oriented. That is to say, we know very well on whom our bread and butter depends and what we need to do in order to sustain ourselves in the vocation and profession for which we have prepared ourselves. I used to write sermons when I was in my parish based very carefully on the text and on what it said, and tried to apply it as honestly and fearlessly as I could to my congregation. And then I would stand up on Sunday morning and look out and see Paul Smith and Emil Bolinski and Gertrude Lansing and Will Hank. And then I would do one of two things. I would either leave out whole paragraphs, or I would say them so abstractly and obscurely that I could have the satisfaction of having said the truth without having to pay the consequences. Once on a Sunday morning, Jimmy Gray got up from the fourth pew in the middle of the sermon and stomped out. And everybody knew he was stomping out, and I knew he was stomping out, and I knew why. And it's not very much fun to preach and have somebody get up and walk out on you because of what you are saying. I fear, in a sense, that what has happened to the whole role of clergy in the churches today is not that we are apostles any longer. One sent, apostello means to be one sent from God with a message. We are not so much the sent ones as chaplains. And I define a chaplain as one who performs religious services for people who either cannot or will not perform those services for themselves. What we really have today are groups of families in sufficient number to be able to afford a chaplain. That is, one who will provide them with the religious services that they have come to expect. And the chaplain leads the congregation's weekly worship for those who want that sort of thing, baptizes when people want a baptism, marries when people want a wedding, buries when people want a funeral, provides catechetical instruction for the young, even though the parents send them to Sunday school and to confirmation instruction, confirms them then also on demand, visits the sick when called, sees to it that the congregation is adequately supported financially, that the budget is met, sees to it that the congregation's membership roles remain either reasonably intact or, if possible, growing, and in general looking ahead to that perhaps next move in the career, to the larger parish or the bigger salary or the next leg up in the hierarchical ladder. That's what makes us, in a sense, then chaplains. And the denominations even have a certain character to them. So if you want a certain kind of religion or a certain kind of religious perspective, you will be a member of that particular denomination. Or if you belong even as H. Richard Niebuhr pointed out in a devastating study on the social sources of denominationalism, if you belong to a certain class, you will join a certain denomination. William White, in his study of the organization man, pointed out that as people move up the organizational ladder to vice presidencies and presidencies, they change denomination from Methodist for the lower ranks to Lutheran for the middle ranks and Episcopalian and Presbyterian for the upper ranks of the denomination. And these characteristics affect the laity as much as the clergy, so that it's a common problem for us. When the Catholic Church had its major liturgical reforms back, I think, about 1966, when they went from Latin to English in the Mass, and on the first Sunday in Advent, all the altars were moved out. I went to my barber in Elmwood Park a couple of weeks later, and all bubbling over, I thought, boy, we're really going to have a good conversation today. And I said, well, how do you like the new liturgical changes in the Mass? He looked at me, and he glared, and he said, if I'd have wanted that, I'd have been a Protestant. He didn't want an English Mass. He didn't want any of that stuff. If he'd have wanted that, he'd have been a Protestant. He was getting what he wanted. He was getting the kind of religion that he wanted. I work a lot in various churches in Columbus, Presbyterian, Episcopalian, Congregational. It's interesting, you see, the Congregational Church is known as the sort of social activist church. If you want to be a social activist and a Christian, you go to First Congregational. That was Washington Gladden's church back in the turn of the century. But if you want sort of personalized religion, then you go to Overbrook or Broad Street Presbyterian Church, because that's where you get that sort of thing. And if you don't want much religion at all, you go to the Episcopal Church, because that's where you don't get much religion. They know how to leave you well enough alone. Now, the point is, then, that it is easily possible, once again, for clergy to be bought, and cheaply at that. Robert Jensen's major point, I think it's one of the most interesting discussions of the meaning of ordination that I have ever seen, is that the clergy have as their role in the church not primarily the serving of people, but primarily the serving of the gospel. That is, they are to tend the authenticity of the gospel in the midst of the congregation. Their function and role is to say, there are many things that we would like to have be the gospel, many words that we would like to hear, but they may not be authentic and faithful versions of the gospel. The task of those who are under orders, under holy orders, the task of those people is to tend the authenticity of the gospel in the midst of the congregation. And if you have a congregation that is attuned to the gospel, then the charge of that congregation to the pastor will be, we authorize you to tend the gospel among us. I think one of the things that's happening in the Lutheran Book of Worship is the sense, once again, that the whole congregation has the ministry. All of the people have the ministry. And as persons who have the ministry, the whole congregation is called to engage in ministry to one another. The pastor in the Lutheran Book of Worship is called president of the assembly. That is, not the one who does ministry on these people or serves them with a ministry, but who presides over the ministry of the whole congregation as it functions in its inner dynamics, in its serving of one another. I talked yesterday about seeing this parish in Albert Lea where the laity, 100 of them, would pick up these communion packets after the 9:30 service and fan out to the shut-ins. You see, that's a marvelous vision of the congregation tending to its own needs. Sunday school teachers would be another example, but one could think of many others. And then the whole community as a body engaged in ministry for the world. To have that kind of a vision shared by clergy and laity alike brings us, I think, much closer to the kind of vision that the New Testament has. And I wonder whether salaried clergy don't make it very difficult for us to achieve that kind of vision today. Well, I raise the question. The task of taking up our ministry is the one to which we are all called, and we have to ask ourselves very carefully what in the world we are doing to the authenticity of the gospel in our midst if we say we're not paying you to teach such and such a thing. I think one of the most exhilarating moments that I have ever had in my life occurred on the occasion of Fred Moyser's inauguration as president of the Lutheran Seminary in Columbus back in 1971. Kent Knudsen was then the chief pastor, the presiding bishop of the American Lutheran Church, and he came to that occasion. He didn't have the sermon, he didn't have the major address. Walt Wietzke had the sermon and Fred Moyser had the address, and they both said great and brave things. But Kent took about 2 minutes to give a charge to Fred and to the faculty on that occasion. And I can't repeat his words exactly, but I know the sense of them because they were just burning, beautiful words. He looked at the faculty and at Fred and he said, there are a lot of problems that the world and the church have. They demand the very best theological thinking and effort, the most critical minds that the church can put together. Do not fail us. And then he laid hands on Fred, and it was just one of those moments. Mostly my experience has been, from laity and leadership alike, don't rock the boat, you know, don't get us into any trouble. Don't say too many controversial things. Don't confront us with any of the hard issues. Or if you must, do it gently. But for once, you see, somebody who had to bear a large share of responsibility for the life of the church and for the authenticity of the gospel, and somebody who, if the seminaries really were seed beds for the faithfulness to the gospel in the life of the church, was going to have to take an awful lot of crap. That one person said to us, do your job. Do not fail us. You know, I have rarely heard a word like that. What would it be like if a church council, you see, would say to its pastor, I know we're paying you our salary, but what we're paying you for is to do the job, to tend the faithfulness of the gospel in the midst of us, to raise the hard issues, not to be like a hired man, that's Jesus' word for those who don't really care about the sheep, but who do milk them in a bad way. Don't be a hired man, but be a shepherd who cares for the sheep, even to the point of saying the hard words, confronting people with the hard issues, raising all the controversial questions, tend the gospel, you see. What would it be like if a church council said to its pastor, do not fail us? Wow, you know, I think that would be an exhilarating moment in the life of the church.
So what you're saying is the market for truth is very small, and the market for a lifestyle is very large. And the pastor that wants to preach the truth and do it well has very little market.
No, maybe the person who wants to do that and who sees that as a genuine call ought to be prepared to travel light. I think that's the point. That's what Paul is saying here. The heavier the investment that we have, you know, the more debts we pile up with our credit cards and the more mortgages we have and all kinds of other stuff, the less likely it is that we will really be able, when the chips are down, to say the things that need saying and to be the kind of person that needs being. C.S. Lewis comes to mind again from Problem of Pain. He says, when we begin to care about someone, that is the point when we will see the blemishes most clearly. He says, love sees blemishes more clearly than hate, and loves unto perfection, loves in spite of them and loves unto perfection. If that's what we are called to be in the church, then maybe the price for that is traveling light. As Paul did. He says, you could support me, but I didn't want to put obstacles in the way of the gospel. That's the point. I think it's such an enormous vision that it just exhilarates and terrifies at the same time. Well, please.
Paul, you know what you're saying about if you're going to be that type of person, maybe you should travel light. Also, if you're going to be that type of Christian, maybe you should travel.
Ah.
Because our society is not one that's geared to people traveling light.
See, and I wonder whether whole congregations ought not travel light. For example, we have a lot of privilege today. Clergy and churches have a lot of financial, economic privilege in America. It's astonishing to me every time I fill out my income tax that I get double deductions for my house payments. I can deduct them on the one hand, the interest at least. I can deduct the interest under interest. I can also deduct it under parsonage allowance. And in fact, if I do not do that, the IRS will do it for me. They say the law says so-and-so. So that even if I don't take the double deduction. Now that's a sizable subsidy from the United States government that I get every year, just as clergy. But congregations, too. We pay no real estate taxes. In fact, all contributions to churches are tax exempt. It is to people's advantage in certain tax brackets to give lots of money to charitable institutions. We watch and guard those privileges very carefully. I wonder what it would be like, you see, if we traveled light, if we rented facilities or tried to set up maybe symbiotic relationships with some enterprises. In New York City, I worked in a parish where they had a parochial school in the first floor of an apartment building, and we're able to use rents from that apartment to support a portion of the cost of that school. That was a way, in a sense, of traveling light. So I guess I'm just wondering whether that might not be a good question for us as individuals and as communities to ask. We might have a better chance at some faithful witness in the world if we weren't encumbered and bought. Well, phew, it's hot, and not just because of the fire. Let me go on to the second issue, to women in clergy roles. These are short passages that we can read, and Isa is going to pick this up again a little bit later. So we can't even read all, one of the main passages is in 1 Timothy. It's doubtful whether that is Paul, but it is certainly has echoes of some of Paul's things. Here is what Paul says, 11 verse 2. I commend you because you remember me in everything and maintain the traditions even as I have delivered them to you. Poor Paul, I think this is so wonderful again. In verse 17, he's going to say, but in the following, I do not commend you. Here he says, I commend you because you remember me in everything. And he forgets that just, you know, 17 verses later, he's going to clobber them good. But here he commends them. All right. even as I have delivered them to you. But I want you to understand that the head of every man is Christ, the head of a woman is her husband, and the head of Christ is God. I'm not sure what all of that means, but let's go on. Any man who prays or prophesies with his head covered dishonors his head. But any woman who prays or prophesies with her head unveiled dishonors her head. It is the same as if her head were shaven. For if a woman will not veil herself, then she should cut off her hair. But if it is disgraceful for a woman to be shorn or shaven, then let her wear a veil. For a man ought not to cover his head, since he is the image and glory of God, but a woman is the glory of man. For man was not made from woman, but woman from man. Neither was man created for woman, but woman for man. Oof. That is why a woman ought to have a veil on her head, because of the angels. I must confess, I have not read a satisfactory explanation of that phrase in all of the stuff that I've read. I do not know. Nevertheless, in the Lord, woman is not independent of man, nor man of woman. For as woman was made from man, so man is now born of woman, and all things are from God. In this verse, Paul seems to be saying, if you are in the Lord, that is, if you have moved out of the structures of creation, at least insofar as the tradition of Genesis was held to be an accurate account of the origins of the world, insofar as you have moved out of the structures of creation and are in a community that can be described as in the Lord, the same things don't seem to hold. In the Lord, woman is not independent of man, nor man of woman. Here he's not talking about headship now, but interdependence. For as woman was made from man in the created order of things, so man is now born of woman, and all things are from God. But then he goes back to his comment, judge for yourselves, is it proper for a woman to pray to God with her head uncovered? Does not nature itself teach you that for a man to wear long hair is degrading to him? But if a woman has long hair, it is her pride. For her hair is given to her for a covering. If anyone is disposed to be contentious, we recognize no other practice, nor do the churches of God. Now, I don't know what all this means, but a couple of things at least seem to me to be clear. One thing is that Paul assumes here that women are going to be praying and prophesying in the community. His only concern is what kind of symbolic garb men and women wear or do not wear as they engage in this activity. Peter Brunner, who is one of my teachers, says that Paul here is talking about spontaneous prayer rather than and prophesy. Prophesy doesn't mean to predict the future. Prophesy means to proclaim, to preach, literally. I think we would probably say something like, women should not proclaim or pray, lead in prayer in the assembly unless they have their heads covered. Brunner says, oh, that refers to sort of spontaneous comment in the conduct of the service, doesn't refer to prepared stuff. I don't see that here in the text at all. I think that's a kind of specious comment. But at any rate, women are assumed to be praying and prophesying. Paul's main point is they're to do so with their head covered as a sign that the husband is the head of the wife and Christ is the head of the man and God is the head of everything. And men are not to have their heads covered and not to have long hair. One of the interesting things that I observe about all of the people who want to say this passage means women are supposed to be subordinate and they're not supposed to have public office in the worshiping assembly of the congregation. I don't see these people mounting a campaign to cut men's hair a certain length, nor to insist that women wear veils or long hair or a certain kind of head covering. The other passage, let's take a quick look at that one, 1 Corinthians 14. verses about 33 to 36. In one sense, we should read this in the whole context, but let me just read this paragraph for the moment. God is not a God of confusion, but of peace. As in all the churches of the saints, the women should keep silence in the churches, for they are not permitted to speak, but should be subordinate, even as the law says. If there is anything they desire to know, let them ask their husbands at home, for it is shameful for a woman to speak in church. What? Did the word of God originate with you, or are you the only ones it has reached? Now, the question is, what in the world is Paul saying here? In this whole chapter, the chapter from which this comes, is a chapter in which Paul is addressing ecstatic speech in the church, glossolalia, what we would today call speaking in tongues. And the thing I keep wondering as I read these verses, especially comparing them with 1 Corinthians 11, where he says, you know, it's all right for women to be praying and proclaiming in the church, but with a veil on, I keep wondering whether maybe what he isn't talking about here is this ecstatic speech. Because he is saying in verse 30, if a revelation is made to another sitting by, let the first be silent. He's trying to say we simply cannot have a chaotic assembly with everybody engaging in ecstatic speech with no attempt to edify, so that basically he's talking about silence. And here it may well be that a strong cultural perspective is coming into play. There are two traditions that lead us to that. One is the Jewish tradition, which is strongly anti-feminist. The rabbis once prayed, thanking God, among other things, that they were not born Gentiles or women. Where women were barred from the synagogue, if you were a woman, you couldn't be a founder of the synagogue, you couldn't read in public, you were behind a screen, only the men functioned. That was one tradition. It may be the one he's referring to when he talks about the Torah. In Greek society, the only women who were educated and who were permitted to participate in male discussion were courtesans, prostitutes. Wives had as their sole function bearing children and managing households, and they weren't even taught frequently, so that they could not read or write, and certainly weren't thought to have any intelligence or education to permit them to participate in men's affairs. Now, Paul may be saying, if women are engaging in this kind of ecstatic speech, it may be that people are going to raise all kinds of questions about what kind of an assembly this is, and it may be very culturally conditioned. In any event, the major question that I would want to raise is whether Paul is here even talking about what we would today call the pastoral office in the church. I don't think so. I mean, I don't think that this is a reference to the pastoral office at all, at least not as we understand it. I think these passages are inappropriately applied to the question of whether or not we should have women in seminary and women in pastoral office, but they have been so applied strongly in the Catholic Church, less strongly in the Protestant churches in recent years, with great difficulty. I raise just one last question, and then I want to us have a chance for some discussion. I think right now we are prepared in principle, LCA and ALC at least, to have women clergy. The practice is something else. It's more difficult, admittedly, for women to receive calls to be parish pastors than for men, so that it may well be that congregations are not yet ready for this. And I'm not even so sure that much beyond principle is there among the clergy and in the seminaries. I taught a course a couple of years ago with on Church and Holy Spirit, in which I started the course by asking all of the male students present how many of them were in favor of the ordination of women. Every hand went up. How many of them, I said, they were all seniors, how many of them would use their first call into a parish as an occasion to prepare that congregation to call as their next pastor after them a woman? None. Not a one. They would support the ordination of women if it became an issue, if somebody else brought it up. I said, well, maybe these are times when it ought to be made an issue, when this really ought to be incumbent upon us as one of our agenda items in pastoral ministry, to prepare congregations for this. So I think, theoretically, we all say yes, or probably we all say yes. If it comes down to it, how many of us really would be prepared to have, as senior pastor of great and impressive 2,000-member 15th Lutheran somewhere, a woman pastor, you know, maybe an associate down the line someplace, but as senior pastor, well, I raise the question. We have with us Evelyn Streng, who was on the ALC's committee that brought the recommendation back in 1970 for the ordination of women, and I'd like Evelyn to say just a word about her experience with all of that.
At the time, Dr. Fred Schuck was the president of the ALC, and I was on the ALCW, Women's of Illinois Executive Board. And Dr. Schuck met with the ALCW board and said, we are talking about the ordination of women, and you women only would be interested in going to
marvelous.
Limited to any one sex or any one group, and that there are so many opportunities of service, and are not limited to any one kind of person. It's been a great experience seeing what's happened in the church. We've come a long way.
Thank you. Please.
Well, there was just something in my Sunday school class. We came across this, and some of the girls in the class said, wow, this comes from the Old Testament. Acts 2:17-18. Would you comment on that?
Verse what?
Acts 2:17-18, where Joel prophesies that women will be proclaiming the news.
Yeah.
What has the church done with this over the years when they were opposing ordination of women?
You mean, what has the church done with this, with these passages?
Yeah, the prophets and Joel. During the years where they said that God did not want women to be preaching, it seems to me in these verses that God says that this will happen.
I think that we are not looking, because we're limited to Corinthians, we are not looking at two of the key passages. The first one is, the negative one is 1 Timothy. And in 1 Timothy 2, verses 8 to 15, Paul, or at least the author of that, seems to say women are not to exercise authority over men. And as the role of the clergy came to be seen primarily as an authority role, that passage was held to imply that women were not to function in a leadership role in the priestly office before the Reformation and the pastoral office since it. The other passage is Galatians 3:28, where Paul talks about the breakdown of barriers between Jew and Gentile, slave and free, or Jew and Greek, slave and free, male and female. And many people who still contend that that women ought not to be functioning as clergy say that passage doesn't apply to office in the church. It applies only to our redemption and not to office in the church. I think that that's a specious argument. I think Galatians 3:28 is a key verse, that in fact the church is now following the culture, that our culture is probably more ready to accept women in leadership roles in business and industry and government and education, and the church here has been sort of tagging along when it could have and should have been, if it was faithful to its gospel, providing leadership, that is, showing the way. I guess my own consciousness on this was radically altered during the years that I was a lecturer in religious studies at Rosary College. From 1967 to 1971, while I was teaching at River Forest, I also served as the first Lutheran teacher of theology part-time at Rosary College. All of my administrative superiors in that role were women. Joan O'Shea was my department chairman, and Sister Mary Painter was the academic dean, and Sister Candida Lund was the president. They were as remarkably competent a group of administrators as I have ever seen. The college was superbly administered, and they could exercise authority over me without diminishing my own personhood in a way that I came to respect. I don't see the 1 Timothy passage restricting the statement on authority to the life in the church. I think it's a kind of general statement, and I think if my opposition, I think, to the people who pick a passage here or a passage there is that they're simply not taking the totality of the New Testament witness into account. The Acts 2 passage is an important one. The Galatians 3:28 passage is an important one. 1 Corinthians 11 is important, where Paul implies prayer and prophesying. They're picking out a word here and a word there, saying, well, we can't let you into to the ordained clergy. But they're not consistent. As I said, I don't see a campaign for head covering. I don't see a campaign. In 1 Timothy it says, women shall be saved through bearing children. Well, I don't know what that means. If you're childless, does it mean you're not saved? There are just all kinds of ambiguities in these passages that are never addressed. Just something picked out and we're told this is a binding word, but the rest are not. Evelyn, again?
Can I ask a question about that other passage, the earlier chapter in Corinthians, where it talks about men not praying with their heads covered. Now, there are many Orthodox Jewish sects today where the men pray with their heads covered. Didn't some of the Jewish men at that time pray with their heads covered, or was this a very localized thing?
I don't know. I think the tradition was that they wore shawls over their heads. And the current practice in Orthodox churches is that if you think you are in the presence of God, cover your head if you're a man.
So Paul must have been speaking to not only, you know, culture, but a very localized culture.
I don't know.
I wondered about
that. I just don't know. I mean, I don't know that we know whether or not the tradition of wearing a shawl over one's head in prayer was a universal one for men, Jewish men. Please.
James Smart maintained that the church has been captured by its culture. Do you think, do you agree with him, and do you think that if the women's rights movement had not become prominent in our culture, that the church would even be considering the ordination of women?
You know, that's an important question. Let me just say a couple of things about it. First of all, the ordination of women in most Protestant denominations preceded by some decades the women's rights movement in political affairs. So here, at least in the Presbyterian and Methodist churches, Protestantism was out ahead of, by decades, the culture.
Before,
I don't
before
know whether
the
you
1950s
can.
1950s or before the 1920s or before the 1960s? Which one of those women moved?
Which one of the women's movements?
The 1850s,
yes.
The 1890s,
that's a good point.
The 1920s and the 1960s.
The most recent one is the one I'm talking about.
Well, the big one was the 1920s. That was the biggest one we had.
The one for the vote.
Right.
Yeah. That preceded the current wave of women's liberation. Okay. I wanted to say that the other thing is that I'm not so sure that can be said for, let's say, the Lutheran churches. It may well be that our response was more triggered by the more recent movement for women's rights.
How about European Lutherans? Book that's just been translated
recently into English, was first published in
Swedish in 1958 for the Swedish Lutheran Church with the same type of what is your point? That, well, I mean, if we're reacting to a fad, say, are the European Lutheran churches, if Lutherans are less responsive to any other thing except pressures of
Yeah, I don't know. I can't talk about the Church of Sweden, but in Germany at least the discussion was triggered by, and the admission of women to the pastoral office was triggered by, the exigencies of the Second World War. Mm-hmm. There just weren't men available, and so women who had been studying theology were simply forced to take over pastoral roles. And so in Germany, it came out of the Second World War. I guess the point I want to make is, even if we are responsive to a movement, even if we're responding to something that's happening in the culture, the question is whether or not we ought not to have been taking the lead. That's the question. I think sometimes the culture nudges us into pathways that we would not otherwise have taken, but ought to have taken.
This is a very different issue because you can either say that the women's movement in the cycles of history is when the civilization is at its highest, or you can say, from the same data, that this is the beginning of the decline of the civilization. Now, that is earthly. If it's spiritual that you're discussing, then every woman has to speculate on her own, or substitute a better word, her own spiritual future and what she is going to do about it. And those are different issues.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't think that culture is a consideration in this.
I would agree with that. And what I'm trying to say is that the gospel itself, being in the Lord, as Paul says, that the gospel itself opens up to the church possibilities which may or may not be there in the culture at all, and that certainly are not going to be determined in the final analysis by the culture. That's what I hear you saying, and I would agree with that. Yeah.
Kind of in spite of the culture, rather than regardless of what the culture is doing, sometimes in spite of the culture, we have to be wrestling through these things.
I think you always have to look at your spiritual life and set it aside from the culture. Jesus, we made that. That was emphatic in everything that he said, addressing that kind of an issue, that these are completely different, the earthly life and the spiritual life, and not to get them confused.
Please.
Well, there's another issue, too, as to whether the masculine dominance in the church had been culturally defined during those periods in which there was masculine dominance.
Yeah, I wanted to bring up this morning a very, very interesting book that I read about 2 years ago by Anne Douglas, who teaches at Columbia University. It's called The Feminization of American Religion. And her assumption is that both the clergy and women lost authority in American culture at roughly the same time, the middle decades of the 19th century. And that it was bad both for the church and for women. That prior to that, at least in American culture, women were equal partners with men in the functioning of the economic unit, which was the family. And it was only as men were able to dispense with the necessity, the economic necessity of women, that the clergy roles too, he says, were feminized, or she, Anne Douglas says, that the clergy roles too were feminized, and religion came to be seen as a kind of the role for the effeminate, both in terms of male clergy and in terms of women, who substituted now influence for authority. It's a complex book. It's well argued and sort of frightening. Anne Douglas's thesis is that if women are liberated in the culture, the church may well be liberated for a stronger and more faithful role in American life vis-a-vis the culture. Please.
Well, as I agree, I want to speak about her husband being aware of the Spirit moving. And one of the things I think is happening is another movement that I think is coming by the leading of the Spirit, and that's the priesthood of all believers.
Mm-hmm.
The interdependence of the lay people, quote unquote, with the, and traveling light is for that pastor to allow the leadership to grow up from the
exactly.
And that means that women and men do what they do best, whichever sex they represent.
Yes, and that ties these two topics together. Wouldn't it be something, you see, if in one sense at least we did not have full-time salaried clergy, what kind of gifts would that evoke? Edmund Schlink, who was one of my teachers at Heidelberg too, said that during the war years and during the terrible years when the confessing church had its professional clergy devastated by both the war and the persecution, that the evoking of lay gifts, He himself was a kind of circuit rider. He was the only ordained person for half a dozen gatherings of the confessing church during the Hitler years. And there just had to be lay responsibility for ministry. It may well be that we can afford chaplains financially, but we cannot afford them Christianly. And the laity hurts itself and its ministry by being able to afford chaplains. Not only because it is able to say, we can tell you what to preach because we're paying your salary, but because it stifles, discourages lay gifts of ministry. Back there.
Just an observation. Recently I read a couple articles about this is what's happened in China when the church was moving underground, and that basically the laity has taken over the job in China of providing on a mutual basis without a pastor, without a church.
Be an interesting, yes, they do not have full-time salaried clergy in China now. I'm going to permit two more comments, and then we got a break, although this has been a marvelous morning, and Etha will continue it at 10:30. First of all, Krista.
Yeah, I was going to say, some of the most growing churches in Portland are the ones where everybody is allowed to participate, use the gifts they have there. It's not just one minister, and I think that's a neglected area. The minister needs somebody else to minister to him. And like five or six, and then lay people doing different things wherever the gifts are. And these churches are going by leaps and bounds. I mean, they cannot go very fast enough.
Thank you. And last comment.
I visited with a congregation this past winter that was a mission congregation, and they had tried for a year and a half to call a pastor, and for various reasons they were able to get one. And they started telling me about what was happening in their congregation, and I got down and said, what do you need me for? And they said what you said. We need guidance. They were right on.
Yeah.
Right on. These beautiful lay people knew exactly what it meant to be the church. It meant, and the function that they wanted the pastor to come in was not to do their work for them, but to guide what they already had going. It was just an exhilarating happening.
Thank you. We are not through with this topic. I'm just going to cut it off this morning, because tomorrow, Corinthians 12, 13, and 14 is about the variety of gifts in the church. That's what we'll talk about. See you then. Thank you.